From 90.7 WFAE Charlotte, it's Charlotte Talks. I'm Chris Clackham, sitting in for Mike Collins. The upheaval on Wall Street has caused uproar and upset across the country, into your neighborhood, and very likely right inside your portfolio and or pocketbook. Efforts are well underway to rescue and avert what has been described by billionaire investor Warren Buffett as an economic Pearl Harbor, by others as a financial sector tsunami. So let's just get our panel to weigh in on this. From just across campus here at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, Dr. Tony Plath is an associate professor of finance with the Belk College of Business Administration at UNC Charlotte. He's been part of the faculty here since 1987. Dr. Plath, highly regarded expert on the banking industry, which means he has certainly been in high demand this summer in light of the volatility in the industry and the leadership transition at Charlotte-based Wachovia Corporation. Dr. Plath, welcome. Good to see you.
Good to be here, Chris.
From Davidson Way, Dr. Vikram Kumar is a professor of economics at Davidson College, a position he has held since 1986. Dr. Kumar is also teaches courses in money and banking, international finance, macroeconomic theory, and the history of economic thought. He's also taught at Vanderbilt University, served at the World Bank, the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, and at the Wachovia Corporation, then when it was First Union. Dr. Kumar, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Chris.
Also joining us in Charlotte Talks regular and about the best known economist in our area, Dr. John Connaughton, is also with the Belk College of Business Administration at UNC Charlotte as a professor of economics. He's been giving his quarterly economic forecast for the Charlotte region, for North Carolina, with a great deal of accuracy, I might add, for years now. Dr. Connaughton, welcome. Good to see you again.
Good to be here, Chris.
I was going to start this off by asking, the normal questions about what led to this and maybe get into the bailout and the whole thing. But let me ask you this, with the bailout being the big news of the day, Dr. Connaughton, what would happen if we just did nothing and let these institutions fail?
Well, it wouldn't be very good for the average American because what we're dealing with here is a liquidity crisis. Banks and other institutions are strapped. The financial system basically ground to a halt last week, which is why this plan was put up and devised, simply because cash was being drawn out of the financial system. And what that means to the average American is that you would not be able to buy a car. You would be because you wouldn't be able to get a loan. It'd be very difficult for you to get financing for a home. And for businesses, it'd be very difficult for you to get that working capital you need for the mismatch between your accounts payable and your accounts receivable. And people would start losing their jobs. That's my take on it.
Dr. Kumar.
Well, I mean, there are two issues here. I mean, one is that, you know, the markets are not working well. I mean, normally, you know, when there is a fluctuation in the market on the supply or the demand side, prices tend to change and clear the market. But the problem, the main problem at this point that I see is that it's a problem of psychology. I think that people don't have any confidence in the valuations in the market. They don't have any confidence in dealing with counterparties. So that has essentially led to this credit problem that John alluded to.
The common folk don't have confidence, or is it that people also in the business don't have confidence in the people in the other parts of the business?
Yeah, it's mainly the big players who don't have confidence in each other.
Right. Dr. Plath, your take.
I'd agree. If we lose credit, as John said a minute ago, then essentially we lose spending. We're a debt-driven society. When that happens, when the banks stop lending to one another and stop lending to consumers and businesses, then the unemployment rises and we get into this feedback effect. If people don't have a job, they can't make their mortgage payment, they can't buy a car, we're in real trouble.
And I just want to piggyback on what Tony said, because I want to get a number out there. Tony said we're a debt-oriented society or a debt-driven society. Just so everybody understands, we'll put a number out there. 55 to 60 trillion is the amount of debt in this country. That's public and private. That's federal government, state and local government, businesses, and households. That's the sum of the total debt.
And we save nothing.
Well,
you can't save if you owe.
Yeah.
True?
And we keep borrowing.
And we do keep borrowing, which brings up one of the questions that one of our listeners emailed before the show even began. Where is the money going to come from? Where is the $700 billion going to come from that Hank Paulson is up on Capitol Hill asking for? Where's the money going to come from?
We're going to borrow it.
Yeah. From?
Well, the Chinese and from other citizens in the U.S. that in turn provide treasury securities, treasury bills, treasury bonds.
Is it true that most of the debt that we the debt that has accumulated right now, which is what, Dr. Conrad?
It depends on what you're talking about.
I'm talking about federal government debt.
Which is about $9.8 trillion. So this will add $700 billion or another. So it will go from $9.8 to $10.5 trillion over the course. But you got to put this into perspective. If we looked at that debt 6.5 years ago, it had been $6.2 trillion. So these folks that are worried about the $700 billion, where it's going to come from, they didn't have any problem spending $3.5 trillion in additional debt in the last 6.5 years. That seemed to become pretty easy. That's the last $700 billion they're fighting over.
Who is the biggest debtor nation? Who is the big? What nation do we owe the most money to?
Probably China, at this point in time.
And just how dire, we've heard all of these descriptions, all of these hyperbolic descriptions about how dire these circumstances are right now. What's your description, Dr. Plath, of the situation that we're in right now?
We're to a position where we need government intervention in the market because the credit
market. Does it pain you to say that, by the way?
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Why?
It really does. Just because there are so many financial institutions that really are victims here rather than causes of the crisis. I mean, they're experiencing a decrease in the value of their loans for the same reason that we're experiencing a decrease in our housing price or our housing value. And that is, we're all caught in a market where credit is not available and where banks are unwilling to lend to one another as well as consumers. So at the end of the day, what happens is we've got chaos in the banking industry at this point, largely because there were a few large banks that made these securitized loans and, you know, really took more risk than they should.
Dr. Kumar weighed in a few moments ago about the psychology of this all. What does it do to your psyche when you hear that the U.S. Treasury Secretary was on one knee last night pleading for support for the program he's presenting as a bailout?
Yeah, it's not very confidence-inspiring, I have to say. normally the way I look at it is when corporations, try to manage the security, I'm talking about information technology, they turn to computer hackers, to try to test the systems. Now, in this case, we have a very difficult problem, technically difficult, legally difficult problem. And the people that, you have to go to are people who actually, know the intricacies of how these things work. The Secretary of Treasury has been, pilloried in some quarters for, his background and, he represents a certain, type of individual in this system. But the fact is that, he, of all people, knows and understands how this system works. And Mr. Bernanke, the chairman of the Fed, he is a person of very, very superior caliber, and he's an outstanding scholar in what causes, declines in the economy. And with these two people, I do have a lot of hope that their views are not going to be discounted so thoroughly as it seems Congress is intent on doing. But today, of course, it'll be a very important day. And to some extent, I think the credibility of Congress is denominated, at least in the short run, in the Dow Jones Industrial Average. I mean, if it goes up, I think that Congress credibility would be on the rise a little bit. So,
speaking of Ben Bernanke and speaking of psychology, and I have to agree with you that there is this calm that he presents, brings to the table, an academic calm, and that they're quite possibly, he has an academic answer to this. However, he's using language that we never hear the Federal Reserve Chairman use. He is almost to the point of pushing, it seems like to me, a panic button. Am I wrong?
No, I don't think you're wrong at all. People need to understand Bernanke's research area was in the Great Depression. I mean, he understands what caused 29 and 33, and he he understands it. I suspect he sees some of the same signs.
There is no better person in the world to have this job at this moment in time.
At this moment.
He knows more about economic collapse than anybody in the world.
And Bernanke, as chairman of the Fed, has been for the last 6 to 9 months trying to inject, it was basically back to last December, been basically trying to inject liquidity into the system using the traditional Fed tools. He's been pushing money and having these side auctions for money, all kinds of ways to try to increase liquidity in the financial system, and he's largely been unsuccessful at it. And as a result of that, he realizes that this is a serious problem, uncharted territory.
Look at WaMu this morning. Yeah. I mean, you know, WaMu failed in essentially 10 days. The run on the bank began on September 15th.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a 10-day period, that institution, remember, this is a $300 billion institution.
Sixth largest depository institution in the country.
Is
it not the biggest mortgage lender? Did I hear that correctly?
Countrywide
would be.
But as a depository institution, a retail bank, it's the sixth largest in deposits in the nation.
Which, to piggyback a bit, Dr. Connaughton, off of what you were talking about a few moments ago, about all the so much of the debt that has been run up in the last 6.5 years, what's terribly frustrating for those of us who are truly, when it gets right down to it, unsophisticated in these particular areas, is that we go back and we Google words like economic Armageddon, and we go back and we find that people like Stephen Roach with Morgan Stanley in 2004 predicted that this very day was going to be coming, and nobody was paying attention. How frustrating is that for you guys on the expert side of the table?
We saw this 10 years ago. We saw as Fannie and Freddie got large and they concentrated their assets in real property, and as they took on increasing amounts of risk, Bernanke predicted it, Greenspan predicted it, other people in business predicted it. We saw this happening a long time ago. It is frustrating.
Yeah, but we're asking Congress now to come up with a solution within one week.
If I can sort of say here that the number, the $700 billion number, first of all, it might go up, but chances are that it's going to go down. I think that, you know, if the markets turn around, I think the true cost, you know, of the bailout is going to be much smaller. The second thing we have to understand is that compared to the size of the eventual problem that might actually, you know, burden us, you know, if nothing is done, this is not a very large amount of money. And it is not a very large amount of money relative to the size of the U.S. economy. I mean, if you look at both the budget deficits and the national debt, in terms of the size of the economy, it compares very favorably with most of the European economies.
Understood. In today's dollars, the Marshall Plan that rescued Europe after World War II was $100 billion. A fraction of what is now being asked to bail out one street in America.
Had a little bit of inflation since then.
In today's dollars.
In today's dollars?
In today's dollars, the Marshall Plan cost the United States of America $100 billion.
Yes, but you're not telling us in today's dollars what the size of the American economy was at that time.
Right.
And I would venture that the American economy is way bigger in proportion than it used to be.
Right. Yeah. But I think, Chris, you know, Vikram mentioned an interesting point here, and that is what can happen on the downside. If you think that $700 billion is a big number to deal with the defaults in the mortgage industry that we've got right now, let's crank the unemployment rate up to 10 or 12%, and then we'll start to see how much of that 55 to 60 trillion starts going into default. And then you've got a really big number to deal with. So this is a plan. It's not a well thought out plan. It's not going to be a perfect plan. You can't put it in place in a week and cover all the contingencies. It's not going to happen, but it is a plan.
Dr. John Connaughton, the economist at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, is joining us, as well as Dr. Vikram Kumar from Davidson College, professor of economics up there. Dr. Tony Plath, who's an associate professor of finance, the Belk College of Business Administration at UNC Charlotte. We're back with more in a moment.
Charlotte Talks made possible in part today by Charlotte Country Day School, at the corner of Fairview and Carmel Road, offering a diversity open house with info about diversity initiatives. October 1st at 7 p.m., details at charlottecountryday.org. And by the Charlotte Symphony, Andrew Groms conducts Schumann's Piano Concerto with pianist Ingrid Fleeter and works by Dvorak and Berlioz, October 3rd and 4th at Blumenthal Performing Arts Center. Tickets at charlottesymphony.org. Coming up Monday on Charlotte Talks, Mike Collins is back in the studio with a panel of experts to discuss the issues surrounding the upcoming election. election. Americans are greatly concerned about the economy. Many want something done about health care. Others have strong opinions on the war in Iraq, terrorism, and illegal immigration. We'll gather to talk about those issues and how the candidates are addressing them when Charlotte Talks. Monday at 9, here on 90.7 FM, WFAE. We'll get back to our discussion about the economy in just a moment.
The Friday News Roundup. Warning that the nation's entire economy is at risk, President Bush calls for immediate action by Congress to confront the financial crisis. John McCain suspends his campaign and returns to Washington. And Barack Obama says he'll go forward with Friday's debate. The Diane Rehm Show, Friday.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks. Here on Listener Funded, 90.7 FM, WFAE, your NPR news source.
Lawmakers say they've reached an agreement on the bailout bill, but let me ask you this. Is it going to make anything better? I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll keep you up to date on the bailout news, what it means to you, and what happens next, because really, it's anybody's guess. That's next time on Marketplace from American Public Media.
That's Marketplace this evening at 6:30 here on 90.7 FM, WFAE, listener-funded public radio in Charlotte.
We are back on Charlotte Talks. I'm Chris Clackham, sitting in for Mike Collins, joined today by Dr. Tony Plath, Associate Professor of Finance with the Belk College of Business Administration at UNC Charlotte. Dr. Vikram Kumar is a professor of economics at Davidson College. Dr. John Connaughton, well-known economist at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, who gives us our quarterly, takes our temperature on a quarterly basis in Charlotte, North Carolina, in North Carolina. How do you think we're going to weather this storm, by the way, Dr. Conant?
This is really an interesting period of time. It's probably likely that we won't get the rule of thumb definition of a recession, and that is two quarters of downturn in real GDP. But in terms of the broader definition that the National Bureau of Economic Research uses, which is they look at employment and real incomes less transfers, we're probably well inside that. And so whether they call it or not a recession is really remains to be seen, but I think we'll find out in the next month or two.
Now, if you would like to join our discussion either by email or by phone or on our blog, here are the numbers. To Carl here in Charlotte, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323. Outside of Charlotte, 1-800-603-9323. Charlotte Talks at WFAE.org is our email address. The blog is at WFAE.org/Charlotte blogs, and you'll find everything right there. Now, I suppose we need to get into why did this all happen? I don't want to spend a whole heck of a lot of time on blame, but who's to blame for it, Dr. Plath?
There were all kinds of parties that were responsible. Fannie and Freddie expanded lending into areas where they were granting mortgages to people who were of questionable credit quality and really couldn't make the payments for the homes they were buying. People were buying homes that they couldn't afford, regardless of their income bracket or their credit rating. And because banks these days tend to package and sell mortgage loans that they originate, the banking industry, in turn, has partial blame here because they stopped paying attention to the credit quality of their borrowers because they were going to sell the loans after they originated them.
And that was the incentive for the lender to lend the money?
Yeah, well, there was a fee associated with the loan.
Correct.
So when you
the
originate
commission.
The loan, you collect the loan fee. Rather than holding it on your books in an era of securitization, you can package the loan with other loans and you can sell it into the market. If you sell it into the market, you pay less attention to the creditworthiness of the loans in the package and risk goes up.
Okay. Dr. Kumar?
Well, so yes, absolutely, Tony. That would be the mechanism by which all of this went down. But, you know, if you step back a little bit, this was, you know, starting in 2003, you know, the Federal Reserve went into an unprecedented, period of, low interest rates. There was plenty of cheap credit flowing around. Money, you know, the industry was awash with funds, which they wanted to set out. And so that provided the fuel, you know, to, you know, set everything rolling. And the second thing, without a doubt, is, you know, the absolute failure of the regulatory, system. I think that, you know, everybody and their cousins and their uncles knew that these terrible loans were being given out, but nobody in Congress, I might add, either, certainly not in the administration, really raised a red flag on it sufficiently and acted on it. So, you know, I agree with Tony that there are plenty of, you know, blame to go around. This is not really the time to point fingers right now. This is the time to find solutions.
Then I take it that Charles Krauthammer wrote a column today. I don't know if anyone, if any of you guys had a chance to read it, but he was suggesting that we all are to blame for it because nobody was complaining about the low interest rates that we were getting and that sort of thing.
And the banking industry had record profits in 2005 and 2006. None of the shareholders, none of the management teams were paying attention either.
Right.
Well, I mean, normally when the profit rates are high, I mean, you know, it could be one of two reasons. One could be that, you know, there's a shortage of, you know, there's a lot of demand and not enough supply. And that provides, you know, high rates of profit. Unfortunately, the other reason is high rates of profit occur when there's high risk involved. And the second is what seems to have gone down here. So
low cost of funds.
Low cost of funds.
But Dr. Connaughton.
What's critical in this is the securitization of these mortgages. And that's what really has led to this problem. Because just, I don't know if you can do this on radio or not.
Let's
and
do
get,
it.
Get away with it. But what you have to understand is that if you look at any one of these securitized instruments, they literally have bits and pieces of thousands of mortgages in them. And they've got really good stuff, best stuff. They've got better stuff. You know, people you know they're going to pay good stuff, not so good stuff. And then at the bottom tail of these things, they got the liar loans, which was these arms that to people that Tony mentioned probably shouldn't have been getting mortgages to begin with. And the idea was if you put all these things together, the bad stuff that everybody knows is bad will be so small relative to all the good stuff that – and the rate will be high enough to compensate for that bad stuff and that risk that it won't collapse. The problem is that when they put these things together, if you look at one of these bonds, you have no idea what's in there. And that's why that no one can value them. When they talk about the fact that they can't place a value on these things, it's because they don't know what is in them.
Mm.
And they don't know where
they're
that
not
bond,
itemized.
They're not itemized. And that's where that's a, you know, kind of an institutional, a technical problem. And that's one of the reasons why they were able to get good bond ratings from the rating agencies because they really weren't sure what was in there. It was a mathematical formula to put these different risks together. I think what's going to come out of this, and I think that we should stop focusing on justice and blame, and we should start focusing on, one, let's get this system back upright and working so maybe we can keep people in their houses and keep houses from foreclosing and driving prices down even further, number one. And then number two, as we start to progress in that way, we can then start to look at the regulations. And I think one thing that will come out – two things that will come out of this is, number one, down the road we'll get a little bit more regulation on basically quality of the loans. I mean, we're going to require verification of income and a few other things. We'll probably have caps on ARMs and how much the adjustable rate mortgages and how much they can go up. But most importantly, I think that we'll have ultimately these securitized bonds will be identifiable. It will say this is, you know, California vintage 2010 bonds that come from zip code 90201 or whatever.
Mm.
And then if anybody who looks at these bonds will know pretty much what's behind them and they will be able to be valued in the long term.
As well as regulation of derivatives and, you know, hybrid instruments like, you know, credit default swaps and things like that.
Yeah, the other thing that will happen is there's not going to be an era in American financial history again where the underwriter can completely absolve themselves of risk and sell the package into the market. There's going to be skin in the game for everybody that touches the loan, from the insurance company that insures the package to the underwriter to the risk rating that goes on the package. Everybody's going to have to retain a financial interest in what they've done.
Let's go to the phone lines again. Our phone numbers are 704-926-9323, 1-800-603-9323. Email address charlottetalks@wfae.org. We're joined by Dr. Tony Plath, Associate Professor of Finance with the Bell College of Business Administration at UNC Charlotte, Dr. Vikram Kumar, Professor of Economics at Davidson, and Dr. John Connaughton, an economist at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. On to the phone lines now. John, you've been holding for a while. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. My question for the professors is, in the future, to prevent against this kind of calamity, we have an externality, the risk involved, which is not being assessed. How about Robert Shuler's idea of a Pigouvian tax like we have in the cap and trade system for greenhouse emissions?
Anybody?
Well, I think Tony already has brought this up in his comment just a second ago, and that is that what the regulations that will come down later on are not going to absolve all of the different entities from risk. That's the moral hazard question we keep talking about, is the fact that you can create these instruments, and if you can sell them off, then you're not in line to, you know, absorb any of the risk. And so you have an incentive to give these loans out to anybody just to create the package that you can sell. I don't think we're going to let that happen again. I think there's going to be a lot more accountability in the system. If we're going to securitize these mortgages in the future, we're going to have to know exactly what's in that package, and everybody who touches it is ultimately going to be bore some of the responsibility for the risk of it.
That's where I'm lost, though, that you're talking about a sophisticated, cultured organization that sits here and puts together what you referred to, Dr. Connaughton, as a bond, and it had maybe several hundred mortgages in it at various levels of risk. They then turned around and sold that as a security to another alleged sophisticated organization who, are you telling me, didn't have enough sense to ask what was inside the package before they bought it?
Well, I think that they were, I don't want to say misled, but they were comfortable with the idea that it, two things. One, that it was rated fairly well by the rating agency, and they put a lot of faith in that. And I think number two, they also bought into this, this new mathematical finance, if you will, which basically allows them to structure these things in such a way as to, again, I told you earlier, I said, let's suppose that we added up and did the simple algebraic sum, the algebraic average of the risk, and it came out to be 7%. I think that they felt like by packaging these things in a certain way, they can actually reduce that risk to less than the average, to down about 6%, and therefore, and if you could sell it at 6.5, then the risk return trade-off was really good.
And we made the inaccurate assumption that property values would always increase. That's why people were buying these houses in the first place, that they couldn't afford. It was all speculation. It wasn't based on the idea that I needed the house. It was based on the idea if I flipped it in 12 months, I'd make money because the property value would always go up.
Or that I could get a fixed mortgage. Yeah. And I think one more thing about that is that we also have to understand, and Tony brings up an interesting point when he talks about escalating prices, there's only probably a half a dozen regions in the country where this has become a big problem. And that's what is kind of the disconnect. The average person lives in Charlotte or Greensboro. They don't see this. They don't see all of this going on. I mean, you need to live in Southern California, Southern Florida, Ohio, Nevada, or Southern Utah. Then you can really start to see this exact thing that Tony was talking about, where the housing prices had escalated rapidly and then the bubble burst.
It all goes back to housing, though, does it not? The whole thing about existing and or new home sales, though.
I mean, that housing bubble underpins this entire, you know, difficulty. And, you know, the housing bubble, I'd like to call it the Greenspan bubble. I think that it's appropriate to give a name tag to this bubble here.
Why do you call it that?
Because Mr. Greenspan, you know, he was, you know, directly responsible for, you know, maintaining a period of very, very cheap credit, very low interest rates. And Mr. Bernanke, you know, in a sense, is trying to respond to the difficulties that arose from those decisions of the Federal Reserve earlier. But in response to, you know, the listener's question, you know, the financial industry has been under, you know, has undergone tremendous amounts of innovation over the last decade. And I think this is part of this entire, you know, phenomenon of globalization that's been going on. And we've already seen that, you know, it can really work well, except that I think that the pace of it has to be calibrated. And I hope that, you know, securitization is going to come back in a more, you know, solid way. You know, it's going to be very important for the world to have a financial system that is dynamic, that is innovative, but that is also credible, and it knows its own limitations.
Very good. Let's go back to the phone lines again. Let's go to line 3, D in Charlotte. D, thanks for holding.
Yes, sir. Hi. I'll tell you, I'm not a Treasury Secretary, and I don't have no degrees in economics, but I'll tell you, from a taxpayer standpoint of view, I wouldn't pay these bankers a dime. Not a dime. I believe that, I feel that if we set up an agency, a governmental agency, that would, number one, restructure loans, and then correctly match the new homeowners with foreclosed properties that's already on the market, and then once that's in balance, then we can sell those mortgages back to private mortgage companies at a profit for the taxpayer. That would make sense.
Yeah.
And then regulate them from that point on so that this never happens again.
An excellent point. Dr. Kumar is anxious to respond to you.
Well, I certainly appreciate the listener's, you know, concerns and his point of view, and I think he speaks for many, many people in America. I would like to put it a slightly different way. I think that to say that, you know, we are actually paying these bankers all this money is not necessarily true under the circumstances. I mean, in a sense, you know, we are paying ourselves because if we don't do something, then, you know, we're going to see our retirement accounts go down. We're going to see, you know, our businesses begin to collapse. We're going to see that we won't get credit lines to make payroll. Our jobs will be on the line. So I think that, you know, one has to, in this very, very extraordinary time, one has to think somewhat differently. I hope that Congress is going to take a leadership role in this and not a followership role, which I think many in Congress at this point are doing.
Okay. We're going to get to that in a second. Dr. Connaughton, you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I think that what Dee was mentioning, and I think will actually happen in a little bit different form, and that is the government's the only agency big enough that can raise enough capital to buy these mortgages, $700 billion. And remember, we're going to probably buy a trillion and a half worth of mortgages for $700 billion. We're going to buy them in pennies on the dollar. Right now, there's no market value. If you buy enough of these things, then you can do exactly what Dee was saying. You can unbundle these securities, get back to the root mortgage, and then you can go to the mortgage holder and restructure those, the mortgagee, and restructure those to better terms that they can afford, including fixed rates and maybe 40-year amortizations, which will make the monthly payment fit what they need.
Yeah.
Then you've got a good quality mortgage. You can then repackage them and go out and sell them.
John, you mentioned this at the top of the hour, too. This is not a crisis of default in all those loans. It's a crisis of liquidity.
Right.
Basically, these loans are losing value because there's no buyers out there that want to buy these in the secondary markets.
Yep. Yep.
The government can be patient and hold them for a longer period of time and not have to make a quarterly profit.
That's right. And picture this for the viewers. We've got a $10,000 bond. It's made up of a lot of mortgages. 85% of it is performing. People are making their payments on time.
Yeah.
They're not behind on payments yet. And so the security should be worth $8,500 for its performing part. But because there is no market, some banks have written these things off as low as 25, 30 cents on the dollar. They've written them off at, or they're holding them on their books at $2,500 to $3,000. They've written off $7,500, $7,500 of value.
Market value accounting makes no sense in an illiquid market.
That's another show.
I do want to know where the rubber meets the road when these loans were made, especially the ARMs, the adjustable rate mortgage loans were made. Why was there such an insistence that when the interest rate ticked up, why was there such an insistence that the borrower had to pay that particular rate as opposed to renegotiating given the current economic situation?
There was a teaser rate involved originally on the loans, so the loans were marketed in a way that they were offered for the first 6 months of the first year at a below-market interest rate. Remember, as Vikram said a minute ago, back a few years ago, the mortgage market was awash in liquidity. Lenders were competing with one another to, in turn, attract business, and they did it with low rates. When those rates reset, when those loans were a year old,
right,
they were resetting 400 and 500 basis points, 4% and 5% higher than the original rate on the loan. That put people into the point where they couldn't make the payment anymore.
It's kind of like a Ponzi scheme if you really want to understand it. I mean, there was a push in, I think, 99 when the Clinton administration and the Congress agreed that they wanted to make and direct Fannie and Freddie to make more loans available to lower-income people. It worked well for a while, but at the end of the run, they started to, in order to sell these mortgages or to issue these mortgages, they had to reach further and further down into the pool in terms of ability to pay.
As a society, we put people into homes that should not have been homeowners. They should have been renters.
And that was Dr. Tony Plath. Dr. John Connaughton is with us as well, and Dr. Vikram Kumar, professor of economics at Davidson College. We're talking about the economy, and we're back with more in a moment.
Charlotte Talks made possible in part today by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, whose new progress report features digital media innovators. More online at knightfoundation.org. And by DCI Home Resource, a complete design resource for traditional and contemporary custom cabinetry, luxury plumbing, and gourmet appliances, including Sub-Zero, Wolf, Viking, and Miele, at DCI Showroom in Charlotte's South End. Coming up next at 10 o'clock in about 20 minutes on the Diane Rehm Show, it's the News Roundup with guest host Susan Page. In the first hour of the National News Roundup, a panel of journalists will be there for review and analysis of the week's top national news stories, including warning that the nation's entire economy is at risk. President Bush calls for immediate action by Congress to confront the financial crisis. John McCain suspends his campaign and returns to Washington, and Barack Obama says he'll go forward with tonight's debate. We'll talk with David Korn from the Washington Bureau Chief from Mother Jones Magazine, Eamon Javers, correspondent from Politico.com, and Jim McTagg, Washington editor of Barron's Magazine. Then in the second hour in the International News Roundup, a look at the week's top international stories. President Bush delivers his last address before the UN, North Korea threatens to restart its nuclear program, and militants threaten more attacks in Pakistan. Another panel will discuss that in the 11 o'clock hour. The Diane Rehm Show from 10 to noon here on 90.7 FM WFAE. Back to our discussion about the economy in just a moment.
Hi, I'm Tina Simmons. Fall is here, and it's almost time for our fall membership drive, October 16th through the 23rd. And you can play an important role in our success. If you'd like to help out for a couple of hours by answering phones, please email volunteer@wfae.org. Come see our studios, meet the staff, and other great public radio supporters. You can make a difference for WFAE. The parking is free, and so is the coffee. We look forward to seeing you in October.
Actress and singer Diane Carroll has seen and done it all in her more than 50-year career, almost.
I could have been a good wife at some point, but obviously I didn't need that as much as I need my work.
What did he love that there's none of?
The life and career of Diane Carroll later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 FM WFAE, your NPR news source.
We are back on Charlotte Talks. I'm Chris Clackham, sitting in for Mike Collins, joined today by Dr. John Connaughton, economist at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, and gives those quarterly forecasts for the Charlotte area economy as well as the state of North Carolina. Dr. Vikram Kumar is a professor of economics at Davidson College, and Dr. Tony Plath is an associate professor of finance with the Belk College of Business Administration, the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. Yes?
I just wanted to, before I went to break, I just didn't quite get out the last,
last bit and piece
of that. When we talk about these teaser rates or the liar rates that we had, when they adjusted up, the whole theory behind that and the way they were sold was that, don't worry, your home price is going to go up, okay, and you'll be able to refinance a fixed rate mortgage, and you'll have built this equity that you didn't make with payments, but you made because the home price went up, you'd be able to get the fixed rate. Well, when the home prices didn't go up, that's where the whole scheme fell. That's why I call it a Ponzi scheme.
That's why we did these 100% financing arrangements, too.
Right.
The idea was, don't worry about taking on too much debt, because a year or two from now, the house is going to be worth more. You're going to have equity. You can talk yourself into a lot of really bad credit decisions
in a speculative market.
That's
what bubbles are. I mean, they're self-fulfilling prophecies, so...
But going back to what Dr. Plath was talking about a few moments ago, I mean, what was the incentive for the lender to make a risky loan?
It's a competitive market, and we were in a market that was awash with liquidity thanks to the green Spaniards at the Federal Reserve. So the bank makes money in two ways. Number one, they collect a fee from the origination of the loan. It's a very profitable business. Number two, they can in turn service the loan after the loan is packaged and resold. And at the same time, they're not taking any risk, because when they spin the loan off in a package, they've eliminated the default risk associated with the package.
Now, we've heard a lot from Washington, D.C., and even from the president himself, saying that much of what was behind this was the greed of Wall Street.
I think there's greed throughout the system. I think, you know, borrowers...
Is there criminality?
...that they could afford. We're going to find out. Remember,
the FBI is now investigating
you know, a number of these institutions to see if there was criminal fraud, to see whether they misstated financial results, financial performance, and to see whether or not they followed their own guidelines with respect to lending and were true to their shareholders.
Will it get all the way down to the loan officer who turned a blind eye to the debt that a bad borrower had?
No, this will stop at senior management. But again, senior management does need to be held accountable for what they've done. And in many cases on Wall Street, institutions took risk that was not properly characterized in the eyes of their shareholders. They didn't communicate to the market what they were doing.
All right, let's go back to the phone lines. John and Charlotte, thanks for holding so long. John?
Hi, how's everybody today?
Outstanding, hope you are.
Doing well, sitting in line trying to get some gas.
Let us know if you find it.
And where?
Well, I'm not going to give out my superstitious sources. But anyway, after the government has bailed out all of the institutions and whatnot, what organization is going to be put in place in order to dispose of these assets? Are we going to, you know, add to government, or are we going to use one of the existing agencies, or what?
All right. Dr. John Conaday has an answer for you.
We actually have a blueprint. We've done this before. Been there, done that, I guess, is the analogy. In 87, when the savings and loans were collapsing and we lost almost 1,000 savings and loans went out of business,
and the
FSLIC picked up the pieces of it. They wound up with all kinds of, mostly commercial, but there were some residential mortgages and stuff like that they wound up with, and they formed this thing called Resolution Trust Corporation, which basically took the assets, unbundled them, repackaged them, and a lot of these assets were in a lot worse shape than what we're going to get now, in that they were half-built shopping centers and half-built office buildings and things like that. They repackaged them and they sold them, and they probably made a little bit of money on that. We're going to set up a similar type of operation to the Resolution Trust. One of the smart things the Resolution Trust did was they outsourced just about all of this to technical people who knew a lot more about it than any government bureaucrats knew about it. And so it actually worked fairly efficiently.
Is that what Paulson has in mind?
I think that's what he has in mind. But the thing we need to understand is this isn't going to go away in 6 months. I mean, this is going to be a process. They're going to get rid of these things over the next couple to 6 years is probably what we're talking about to get rid of everything. But I think in the long term, there's a possibility we'll make some money.
John, does that answer your question? Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for calling now. Let's stay with the phone lines. Terry has been holding for a while as well. Terry, thanks for calling.
Yes, thanks, guys. Great discussion here this morning. A couple of quick points. I'm a real estate broker here, and I've got a good example at the end of how these bad loans got started. But a couple of things. One is the real big issue right now is this is not a bailout of Wall Street. That's what it looks like. That's how you open your show, Chris. But the truth is if we do nothing, the consequences of this are going to be felt all across Main Street. And we don't have to go to the Great Depression to look at that. This happened in Japan. Their federal government did nothing for 5 years in the 80s. The banks were in ruins when they finally got there. It took their economy a decade to recover.
Right.
So we've got a very recent example and a very pressing reason to do this. I don't think there's a man in America who really wants to bail out a Wall Street firm who made billions. There isn't anyone, but there's a good reason.
Amen. I mean, the caller is exactly correct.
Yeah. Dr. Kumar.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, you're reiterating, you know, what we have said here this morning. And, I mean, if one takes a deep breath and, you know, looks back at history a little bit, then, you know, one can see that, you know, every time, you know, the markets have hiccuped and the government has stepped in, it has actually made the economy stronger. And I hope that, you know, there'll be some degree of optimism, you know, in, you know, the amazingly talented pool of people that exist in America, and some degree of optimism that they will be able to come together and show us a way forward here.
It's important to point out we've spent the last 75 years studying depressions and how to ameliorate the damage. Let's not screw this up. Let's use what we've learned and do this right.
Call us right, though. I mean, it's not a bailout. It's a rescue of the American financial system. And I think that I said this to my wife a week ago when Paulson came up with the plan. I said, we cannot focus on justice. We need to focus on a solution to fix the financial system. Justice will come later.
But we know how to do that.
Yeah. Dr. Kumar.
Just sitting at my vantage point, you know, I would hope, you know, that the essential features of the initial proposal are still going to go through, that this is going to be a big, rescue effort, and that it's going to be reasonably clean. I don't think that, you know, this is the time to burden the rescue, you know, plan with all manner of, you know, goodies that, you know, individual congressmen want to have.
We don't need an omnibus bill right now. There's going to be plenty of time to figure out re-regulation and to figure out how we can contain risk in the system. Let's just do what we need to do to save the credit market right now.
The key thing is, you know, apart from, you know, actually ponying up the money and having this rescue plan, the key thing is that you have to send a signal to the market that turbulent days are not going to be ahead of us. That is the key thing here.
Terry, thanks so much.
We did a good job with that signal last night.
Yeah.
In reverse.
Terry, thanks so much for your phone call.
All right. Well, got time for one real quick addition?
Sure.
Yep. Speaking with a Countrywide exec, asking him what was going on about 6 months ago, he said the dirty secret was that this securitization deal, everything worked for 2, maybe 3 years. Worked so well that these securitized bonds went all around the world. There were investors looking for high interest rates, higher returns. And because of this, they went around the world. And because people, when their loans went bad, they could refinance them, then the problem stayed buried. Problem came when home prices stopped going up in early 2006, mm-hmm. and the default rates started to skyrocket. And that's where things went off the rails. And Dr. Kumar mentioned that this was a Greenspan bubble. It absolutely was. But Dr. Kumar, I'm not sure that it was the easy money as much as the easy money without any regulation.
Yeah, I did say that. I mean, regulatory forbearance was absolutely a very important fact, and you're absolutely right.
The underwriters had no skin in the game.
And, Terry, you swear you're just a real estate agent.
I am, but I also write a blog on this, and I...
Good for you,
pal. I watch this industry, and it's amazing the greed. Real quick, an example. 3 years ago, I had a fixed loan for a client, a first-time home buyer. Fixed loan, negotiated 5.75%, 30-year fixed. She had a friend, though, a friend in the business. And she said, I want to give my friend the business. Well, let's look at the loan the friend's giving her. The friend gave her a 2-year adjustable rate that had a lower monthly payment. This first-time home buyer was concerned and didn't want a high monthly payment. So she got a 2-year adjustable. I said, but in 2 years, and it was about 0.25% less, by the way, hardly anything.
Right.
And I said, in 2 years, this can reset. She says, oh, yeah, my friend just told me I can refinance then.
Refinance then.
So she had a fixed loan available in her hand. She qualified for a perfectly good 30-year fixed. And her, quote, friend, with $6,000 in closing costs, I might add, gave her this variable junk loan.
Oh, gee.
We have to do a better job of shopping for credit in this country.
Yeah.
Okay. We can't just listen to what providers tell us.
Terry, thanks so much for that phone call. I don't want to give too much away for a program that we're going to do next week. Mike Collins is going to do next week about what people should do, you know, the regular guys out there, what they should do. But let me ask you something. Let me ask you three guys, where's the safest place to put your money right now? Should 401ks be rolled over to CDs or where? And Gwen writes this question in because it is a very good, this is what everybody's thinking about right now.
Don't panic. At this point, don't pull money out of the stock market. You'd be selling low only to turn around later and buy high. We will all live through this. The stock market will be a fine place to invest. You can use a dollar cost averaging strategy in this market and pick up some excellent deals in equity. Stay diversified. Don't panic.
Dr. Kumar?
I have actually followed Tony's recommendation.
Is the check in the mail?
Dr. Gonitin.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably a good advice for the average investor, but I think that there are things you could do to protect yourself. Number one, you got to make sure that if you got CDs or anything in a bank that you make sure that you're under the FDIC limit. That's an incredibly important thing. And the other thing is if you've got a 401k and it's in company stock, you might want to look into that as well.
This question too from an emailer, who's really responsible for working all this out though? Is it Congress?
No. It's ultimately the operation of the organization that Paulson will set up, probably in the next month or so when this thing passes, that will actually be the entity that will go out and buy these mortgages and restructure them.
But the parameters will be set by Congress, and so that's very important.
the role of the Federal Reserve, I think, is going to be stronger than it's ever been before. If you look, we need an overarching regulator.
Yeah.
We need somebody that makes sense of this alphabet soup of regulatory organizations we have. Vikram mentioned that regulation is a mess in our industry right now. It's a 30s-era system in a 2008-09-10 banking industry. It doesn't work anymore.
Yes, that's quite true. Though I'm not sure that I would buy the super regulator idea because, you know, Britain had, you know, has a super regulator, the Financial Services Authority, and, you know, they have not, you know, edified themselves, you know, in the public eye either. So,
but we gotta get the contradictions out of our regulatory.
But the regulation.
I agree.
The regulation is going to happen later. As part of this bill, we're going to construct an agency that's going to buy these things up, repackage them, and sell them.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go back to the phone lines here. Bob from Fort Mill. Bob, thanks for holding.
Hey, good morning, folks. The speakers, as well as Paulson and Bernanke, they're talking about our credit economy like it's irrefutably the only way we can function. And nobody ever challenges this wisdom. And from my perspective, the economy is as addicted to credit as – good grief – the economy is addicted to credit like the whole society would be addicted to cocaine. And the solution seems to be that people are putting forth is just make cocaine more available to everybody.
Mm.
And it seems that credit is the, you know, the very root cause of all of this, especially on Main Street.
Part of the solution is to grow the economy, to increase productivity, mm-hmm. to in turn produce more so that our income can sustain the amount of money we borrow. The problem is right now we borrow too much relative to the amount of real income that we have. If we grow our income, and we can do that by growing productivity and growing things in our economy that other people want to buy, places like India and China, then we can borrow an amount of money that can fuel our economic growth. But you've got to produce before you can spend.
Dr. Kumar.
The problem with, you have to make a distinction between short-term credit and long-term credit. I mean, you know, every business needs to have lines of credit to, you know, smoothen out, you know, fluctuations in cash flows and manage their payrolls and things like that. So that is, you know, the probably the first, you know, real, challenge here is to keep that flowing so that jobs can be, kept and payrolls can be met and the real economy can keep humming along.
I understand that part of it, but my question is, why are we not addressing the issue of credit and trying to break our severe addiction to credit, on a Main Street level and live within our means? This would be a good opportunity to do so.
Okay,
I don't think we have a real severe addiction to credit. I think that, if we just take mortgages, we've got about $10 trillion in mortgages out there. That's 20% roughly of the outstanding debt that we have. It would be very difficult for people to save up enough to buy a house cash. We're not talking, these are big ticket items. You're going to live in them. They have long lives, the physical property. It really doesn't make a lot of sense to wait till you're in your 40s till you've saved up enough money to buy a house. The same can be said for cars. I mean, you pay for a car over a 5-year period, 3-year period, whatever the length of the loan is. And it's a long lived asset and you should pay for it over the life of the asset. So when you look at the irresponsible, what some might say is irresponsible debt, say, for example, credit card debt, it's an incredibly small number of this $55 trillion. I mean, it's only $2.5 trillion of consumer debt that's sitting out there on credit cards.
Bob, thanks so much for your phone call. We're going to have to wrap this up. But very quickly, let me ask again, what if we did nothing? Tony Plath.
We're in trouble. We would see a meltdown in the credit market. We would see continuing catastrophe in banking. We would see a rising unemployment rate, and it's only going to get worse.
Dr. Kumar.
It is not an option.
Why not?
It is not an option because, one can easily see visions of the 1930s. I don't think we want to go back there.
How close were we, Dr. Connerton?
Bernanke and Paulson were looking over the edge of the cliff, and they saw how deep it was last week, and they said, we got to move away from this and move away quickly.
And this was a dramatic.
On one knee.
Exactly. He's seen how deep that abyss is, Tony.
We've been joined today by Dr. Tony Plath, Associate Professor of Finance at UNC Charlotte, Dr. Vikram Kumar, Professor of Economics at Davidson, Dr. John Connerton from UNC Charlotte. I'm Chris Clackham. Thanks for listening.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our senior producer is Wendy Herkey. The associate producer is Tim Ross. Aaron Sutton is our research assistant, and our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks archives, upcoming shows, and podcasts, go to WFAE.org.
Charlotte Talks made possible in part today by Dr. James Altizer and the Vein Center of Charlotte, providing state-of-the-art outpatient treatment for varicose and spider veins. Trust the vein specialists. 704-341-1122. And by UNC Charlotte's 2008 Cybersecurity Symposium, Wednesday, October 15th, featuring national speakers Dan Gere and Peter Murphy. Registration at cci.uncc.edu. Events.
This is Neil Conan, host of Talk of the Nation from NPR News. As you listen each morning to WFAE, remember to keep your ear to the radio each afternoon. As the news changes throughout the day, rely on WFAE to keep you connected to the stories, ideas, and people that matter. Listen for Talk of the Nation, weekdays at 2 and news all day on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org.
I'm Mike Collins. Election Day is a mere 6 weeks away. Americans are greatly concerned about the economy. Many want something done about health care. Others have strong opinions on the war in Iraq, terrorism, and illegal immigration. We'll gather with a panel of experts to talk about those issues and how the candidates are addressing them and take a look at some local issues like public and neighborhood improvement bonds and more when Charlotte Talks. Monday at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
Rainy and breezy today, a high in the mid-60s, and rain tonight with a low in the upper 50s, then cloudy and rain tomorrow. Right now, 63 degrees on WFAE Charlotte, WFHE Hickory.
From W.